You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture. Register now for PASA's 2023 conference in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, featuring more than 90 sessions on farming and food systems, as well as mixers and meetups and a trade show. Learn more at pasafarming.org/conference.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And today, we're going to look at Taiwanese food, or the food of Taiwan, as my author has named her book. Taiwanese food is kind of, I think Julia Moskin maybe said it best in the New York Times, a kaleidoscope mix of cultures, as so many different nations are. Look at the U.S. But Taiwan in particular had so many different influences that were actually controlling the island, little island that it is, from the Fujian Chinese to the Hakka to the Japanese, so many different cuisines. And yet people, you say food of Taiwan, and most people will say, well, it's Chinese food. There's a lot of braising, a lot of pickling, a lot of steaming and deep frying, and of course, there are noodles. And we will hear why there's so much different influences in these foods when I talk to my guest, Kathy Irway. Kathy is a food blogger, a freelance food writer, for which she won a James Beard Foundation Award, and the author of the cookbook, The Food of Taiwan, as I mentioned. She also is the author of Sheet Pan Chicken, The Art of Eating In, How I Learned to Stop Spending and Love the Stove. And most recently, she co-wrote a book with the restaurateurs of Win Sun, a Taiwanese-American restaurant in Brooklyn, New York, which just came out this past week. Kathy was one of the early podcasters on Heritage Radio Network with her show, Eat Your Words. Before that, wasn't it Not Eating Out? It was a show?
Yes, thanks, Linda. Yeah. The show was called, the first name of the show on Heritage Radio Network was called Cheap Date, where I interviewed guests about how they would, you know, cook at home and, you know, entertain maybe on a date or just, you know, with their friends. So it was like a home cooking based show. Then I got like some cease and desist letter from some other entity called Cheap Date. And I changed it to Let's Eat In, same topic. But then soon after that, this was very early days. This is like 2009 I'm talking about. Right. I changed it to Let's Eat In, and it was then focused on books and authors of all kinds of food related books. So, you know, cookbook authors, but also food politics exposés and memoirs and even novels about food.
Right. So then it was called Eating Your Words.
Eat your words.
Right, that's all right. and it's interesting because often we would overlap on the
guests that get on. That's right. I love seeing that, Linda.
Then Kathy went on. You went on to host an award-winning show on Gimlet called "Why We Eat What We Eat."
Kathy's
been teaching a writing course at Boston University School of Gastronomy. And she just wrapped up a season, as she said, of Self-Evident Show, a podcast focused on community-driven Asian American stories, of which she is a co-founding partner. The podcast challenges, the little that I listened so far, it challenges the narratives of Asian American experience. And she is fascinated by the intersection of culture, food, and race. And Kathy, you wrote the book Food of Taiwan in, was it 2015?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, tell us how you approached this. Tell us about your background and why and how you got to this topic.
Right. Thanks so much. So my mom is from Taiwan. I always found it to have, I've traveled there when I was little, but I also spent a semester in Taiwan when I was in college. So I always, you know, thought the food was amazing, and I just didn't see much discourse about it in America. So I wanted to just really geek out about it and explore it more personally. And I, you know, if, you know, if I'm the one also looking around for English language resources and just kind of information about this book, I figured maybe other people would too. So I wanted to set out to write a cookbook about it. And then I did. Long story short, yes, eventually I did. Yeah.
I mean, it's always been this enigma to me because, you know, I too, you know, kind of like most people relate the food with the food of China, which is not incorrect, obviously. But the more I learned, and then of course we both did, both had a connection with a noodle producer that even talking about noodles, finding out about the different noodles.
Yeah.
And so then what drew my attention back to it once again was your recent article on
Zhajiang Mian,
an incredible noodle dish that you explored and wrote up for Eater. I mean, you have written for just about every blog and food magazine. I mean, you're all over the place. Congratulations to you. I
think thank you. Terrific.
And they're always really interesting articles, whether it's on Asian food or American, you know, new trends or whatever's happening, because you do, as you said, you geek out. You really, you do the deep dive and get to the bottom of most things. And I like that because that's what I like to do.
Thanks.
So this dish, I said, well, why? I've never really, I heard about the Zhangjiang sauce, the red bean, fermented red bean sauce. But this particular noodle dish, I guess I just never paid attention, never really heard about until I read that article. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and that's not even originally Taiwanese. It's
Exactly. It's very popular in Taiwan, but it's originally from northern China.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us a little bit about a brief history of Taiwan and why there are so many different influences and perhaps competing flavors going on?
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's a very contentious, you know, relationship with China, as most people know. I feel like most people know that China and Taiwan have very tricky relations, and Taiwanese food is really good. So, I mean... But to back up, Taiwan has been an island that has had an Aboriginal population for thousands of years. But you know, it also became a place where people from China found refuge over the years, over the centuries. So one group is the Hakka, who is an ethnic minority throughout China, and there's a rich diaspora of Hakka people around the world, actually, but in Taiwan. And people just across the Taiwan Strait from Fujian have also made Taiwan their home over the centuries, like the modern, you know, centuries of 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. However, in late 1800s, so like 1895, I believe, China lost a war against Japan. It was the Second Sino-Japanese War. And they ceded Taiwan to Japan. So Japan colonized Taiwan for 50 years up until Japan surrendered to the Allies in 1945 in World War II. Then they ceded all their foreign territories. It's a little unclear who now who now owned Taiwan.
Right.
So because at the time, China was embroiled in a civil war of its own. So there was this competing sides. One was the communists. The other was the nationalists. And I think we all know that the communists won. But the nationalists retreated to make Taiwan their home and you know, set up a government there. It was completely separate from China. It was military rule up until the 1980s, however. But it's been, ever since, you know, then a democracy. It's been completely ruled on its own, separate from China, has flourished with a culture of its own, thanks to all the various people who've populated it. As I mentioned, the Aboriginal groups, there was the folks from Fujian province, there's folks from Hakka, but I didn't mention that along with the Nationalist Army, a lot of people from China fled the communists to go live in Taiwan. And that includes my grandparents. So people from all over China, some estimated 1.5 to 2 million folks moved to Taiwan. And so this was in the late 1940s. So ever since then, the food culture has reflected all these rich traditions that have mingled in Taiwan.
Yeah, you can imagine everybody, what does somebody bring with them when they move to a new country? It's food. What they know, and that's their food, right?
Yeah. It's always a long-winded explanation. So
that explains so much to so many people because it is, and it's just a small island. I mean, if you you look at it in comparison to the other, the mainland China around it, it's this little sliver of an island and so many different people living there.
Yeah.
Interesting and an interesting topography. You got the ocean, the mountains. I mean, it's really quite interesting.
It is, surrounded by sea. You got a lot of seafood too. So all those environmental factors really weigh into the cuisine as well.
So with all of these competing cuisines, not even maybe necessarily competing, but just different. I mean, like look at in the U.S., you can go out to dinner one night to an Italian restaurant, another night to a Vietnamese restaurant, another night. You know, I mean, it's
absolutely
right. But there, they've managed to mingle a lot of the cuisines somewhat. It seems to me, reading your recipes and different Taiwanese influence books.
Right. And you mentioned noodles. So wheat-based noodles were something that was really popularized by immigrants who fled northern China to Taiwan. So that's just one example, because a lot of the country's food noodles was rice-based before then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Different climate. It's better for growing rice.
Right. Yeah. So aside from that, the prevalence, of course, of noodles, we all know noodles are very important. Mm-hmm. What are there any other tastes or perhaps cooking methods that to you distinguish a lot of the dishes of Taiwan?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of braised foods in Taiwan. Red braised, which is hongxiao, which is like a technique that it's enjoyed in Hunan province as well as Sichuan. But Taiwan has its own sort of version of it, and it's called lu wei. And things are just steeped in this wonderful, rich, aromatic broth. And you can go to street markets and just choose from an array of different morsels, like, I don't know, fried tofu cubes, perhaps a fish ball here, some vegetable chunks there, and just choose them to have dip, like quickly braised and dipped into this broth and enjoy there. I think that's a really signature specialty that is enjoyed in Taiwan. A lot of folks will say the beef noodle soup that is enjoyed in Taiwan is a real signature dish of the island. And
I did read about that and notice that. Why is that different, and how is it different from a lot of the, the other beef noodle soups you find, particularly in the Asian cultures?
Well, I mean, there isn't really any equivalent of it in China. But it has conspicuous influences from mainland Chinese cuisine. There is wheat-based noodles. There is a little hint of spice. Many cooks in Taiwan will use a little bit of doubanjiang, which is a chili bean, fermented bean paste, in the broth. So people will say, oh, well, this is a mainland-created food. But actually, it doesn't really exist in the mainland. It's a Taiwanese specialty that was invented. People believe in the military villages where people's families, families of the military were housed together communally. So they cooked food together often. And people believe that this is one of the dishes that was invented there.
Interesting. And I interrupted you because you stopped then about what other dishes sort of distinguish the flavors or the cooking methods.
I think that there's a lot of use of fresh basil, which is a Thai style of basil leaves that is used in a lot of dishes. So another like kind of hallmark of Taiwanese cuisine is 3-cup chicken, which is a braised chicken dish that has a lot of garlic and ginger, but at the end, a big fistful of fresh basil is thrown in. And it adds just like a wonderful aromatic. And this dish is kind of like redone as like, you could get 3-cup squid or 3-cup tofu and other styles, other dishes in that style. Basil is also found in fried chicken, crushed up, and like the leaves are deep fried and then sort of served along with the fried chicken bites, or popcorn chicken, as many people call it.
Right. Right.
So that's a fun signature ingredient.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned the street food and street markets. Mm-hmm. And of course, Taiwan, much like a lot of Southeast Asia in particular and mainland, is known for its markets, its night markets.
That's absolutely. Yeah, the huge night market scene where you can choose from so many different vendors and just have yourself a delightfully varied night of snacking and, walking around and just kind of tasting here and there. And that's just a really fun thing for college students to do, for anyone to do, really. When I was there in college, though, it was definitely like that was a thing to go out at night and do.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because people my older age who maybe were born right after the Taiwan became the refuge for non-communists, are very defensive about being Taiwanese and don't say that I'm Chinese, I'm Taiwanese.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, staunchly defending that nationality. And yet, you'll see at the night markets, there's just all this similarity. And of course, everyone's celebrating, having a fun time. And around food, all that seems to melt away and eat the foods. What do you attribute this to?
I think that people have grown up, like folks. Okay, my mother's generation, who my grandparents I mentioned are from mainland China. So my mother's generation might have different feelings about this, but. My generation and folks who just grew up in this blended society and eating, all these foods that were from both or all parts of, Taiwan as well as China and kind of like enjoying. So anything like, wheat based is, kind of conspicuously from a later era of migration to Taiwan. So if you grew up eating that and that's your idea of Taiwanese food, and then you go somewhere else like America, it's all kind of nostalgic Taiwanese to you, right?
Right.
So it's just different generational associations.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I would be speaking more, I guess, about your parents' generation, those people being priding themselves that they lived in Taiwan and, they were, as someone said, I don't know what to call myself. And, you are Taiwanese American.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
yeah,
we have the difference. Japan being such a presence in the country for so long and controlling it 50 years. It's interesting. You said that really the only thing that was, you talked about the train, the food, the trains, and it wasn't the food so much, but just the bento box.
That's right. Yeah. So Japan during the period of 1895 to 1945, as one might imagine, massive modernization occurred. And around the world and also in Taiwan. So, the Japanese rule was responsible for the train system that was built in Taiwan. And, the interesting legacy of it is that bento boxes made for passengers on the train, so they're sold at the railroad stations and it's a perfect, grab and go meal. they're still just as popular as ever. And, you know, they still serve a few classic combos, which usually is a bed of rice, perhaps a fried pork chop or some piece of chicken, or maybe it's tofu, some protein, and a little like a tuft of a sauteed cabbage or some other vegetable, and then some sort of pickled item, like maybe a little slice of pickled radishes. That's the same combo you'll see, and you'll see enjoyed widely throughout Taiwan and in the train stations as well today.
Yeah. Well, and other places as well. I mean, everyone seems to have adopted that, but of course, you know, really had its, has meaning there.
It's a great legacy.
There are a couple of particular food items I want to talk about and recipes from the book. And I want to talk about the new book that you helped co-write on Taiwanese American food. And because your book is strictly Taiwanese.
That's right.
Taiwan, and I like the idea that you kind of morphed and involved this whole new culture and immigration population. So we're going to talk about that when we come back from a brief break. So stay tuned.
Cultivate farms and food systems that nourish, heal, and empower. Register now for PASA Sustainable Agriculture's 2023 conference. Access more than 90 sessions on topics including environmental conservation, food justice, sustainable food and textile production, renewable energy, and much more. Featuring a not-to-be-missed lineup of speakers, including Indigenous environmental scientist and author of Fresh Banana Leaves, Jessica Hernandez, the best-selling author of The Art of Fermentation, Sandra Katz, co-owners of Heritage Seed Company, True Love Seeds, Owen Taylor and Chris Bolden Newsome, and many more. PASA's conference takes place in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on February 8th through 11th, and includes social networking events plus an expansive trade show. Register now at pasafarming.org/conference. That's pasafarming.org/conference.
Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Kathy Irway about Taiwanese food. In 2015, Kathy wrote the book, The Food of Taiwan, Recipes from the Beautiful Island. Kathy, tell me what's the significance of, I mean, it's a beautiful island, but tell me the significance of, does it mean anything like the name?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. So when Portuguese sailors were kind of surveying the area back in the 1600s, I can't remember the exact date, they named the island of Taiwan Ilha Formosa, which means beautiful island. Mm-hmm. And Formosa was the name that Taiwan was known by for quite a while in the English language.
Right.
So it's a nod to that previous name.
Huh. The beautiful island. Beautiful. Well, we were talking about flavors and cooking techniques that might distinguish Taiwanese food from all the other influences. One thing we didn't mention, of course, which is one of the prevalent things that a lot of people mention about Taiwanese food is stinky tofu.
That's right.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So stinky tofu is singularly enjoyed in Taiwan. I mean, it's not the only place where you can enjoy stinky tofu, but I think it's just so common. It's a street food snack that, and it's also served in other dishes. You might find it in a hot pot here and there, but I think the version that at least, you know, brings back a lot of cravings and nostalgia for my mom and other folks who grew up with it is these fried blocks of stinky tofu, crisp, you know, shell on the outside, very pungent on the inside. And it's served with a little bit of pickled cabbage. So it's a perfect kind of like balance of very extreme flavors. But the smell, you can just smell down the block.
And stinky from the fermentation.
So each vendor has their own sort of closely guarded secret recipe for what they put in their fermented brine along with that tofu to make it so stinky. Generally, it's like, a combination of some, you know, vegetables, aromatics, just kind of let that ferment and let your tofu just kind of pick it all up and absorb it.
Right. Well, of course, now fermentation is having its day for all kinds of vegetables and all foods. Mm-hmm. And who knew kimchi would be, you know, the rage, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But that's another culture and another, well, not really, but close by. The Taiwanese American cookbook that you just recently co-wrote with the restaurateurs from Winsan, how does that differ from a lot of this that's in the recipes of your book, The Food of Taiwan? Mm-hmm. And what is the real thrust there?
Yeah, so I was really excited when I started to see restaurateurs, namely Winsan and a few others, you know, around Brooklyn, all 886, actually Kato restaurant in LA, kind of like not so much, you know, try to make this faithful exact replica of Taiwanese food, but really acknowledge and kind of have fun with the new American place and audience. And, you know, it's just like any other diaspora cuisine. It reflects the chefs first and foremost, and their combined experiences, whatever it may be, wherever they may have grown up or come from, as well as an homage or their, you know, wanting to pay respect for the Taiwanese traditions that they love. So, it's a different blend. It's a different twist everywhere, any way you spin it. But at Winsan, I think it was like, it just like, it really worked for the environment in Brooklyn, and everybody just fell in love with this cuisine. So it really helped put Taiwanese food as a whole on the map. But it's a playful twist. I mean, most of the dishes, a few of the dishes are pretty, you know, close to the originals. I would mention the fly's heads, which is a dish of chopped flowering chives, stir-fried with some ground pork. But a few of the dishes are just actually really creative riffs. I'm thinking of one salad, for instance, that is, it kind of deconstructs the ingredients that you might find inside the spring roll that they really love in Tainan. So it's like shredded cabbage and carrots and shrimp grilled on top, but it's like in a tangy, fresh, refreshing salad. So they like made, you know, they took some liberties that like kind of worked for their audience and kind of put their own spin on it. Huh. So that's what I think Taiwanese American food is. It's just kind of playing around with it and giving it your own spin.
And yet you wouldn't want to play around with red braised pork belly. I mean, that you want to keep that as it is.
Yeah, but you could serve it in various different ways. You could, you know, guabao is like the steamed sandwich buns that you would find juicy slabs of pork belly in. But perfect example, actually, just last weekend, 886 and Dominique Ansel Bakery teamed up to collaborate on this guabao, or I think it was a xiaobing. Anyway, it was like a play on that steamed sandwich bun that I mentioned with the savory red braised pork belly slices. Mm-hmm. But they put it in this crusty, like croissant-like bun that was created by Dominique Ansel. So it was a really fun mashup, and it was delicious. Wow. It sold out, yeah.
I mean, that's interesting. It's really an embracing, you know, a couple different cultures.
All right.
Yeah. I like that. That's very good. You mentioned the buns. And mm-hmm. when I read your article on the noodle dish, talk about that noodle dish, the jjajangmyeon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So jjajangmyeon is like a really, as I explore in the dish, it literally translates to fried sauce noodles, But one of the sources I spoke to, Carolyn Phillips, who is a prolific writer of culinary historian of Chinese food, she believes it got mixed up with like mixed sauce noodles, which was a different spelling. And that was how it was referred to in Northeast China, where most folks attribute the dish as originating from. So but basically, it's a deliciously hearty dish that a lot of people draw parallels to bolognese. So you got some fresh wheat noodles, usually thicker variety, and it's topped and it's broth-less. So, you know, they're cooked and drained. And then it's topped with a big ladle of this ground pork or maybe minced pork sauce that is like savory and sweet. It has some, you know, you could add some like onion and stuff like that, but it's basically like a hamburger helper, like smothered over this pile of noodles. And then there's slivers of julienned cucumbers usually served on top as well as some other optional garnishes, like maybe slivered carrots and maybe some scallions, cilantro.
Yeah. Right. Well, and what gives it its depth of flavor and that umami punch is that the fermented bean sauce.
Yes. Tianmian jiang. It actually translates to sweet wheat sauce, but a lot of people translate it as sweet bean sauce. That's something I also explore in the article, like why, you know, I have a couple of theories that I provide in that article, why there's a mix up there. But anyway, essentially, it's a delicious, savory, fermented sauce that's brown and thick. And you just sort of stir it into your ground pork with a little liquid and bada bing, bada boom. You got a great dinner.
Right. Well, I mean, the story, you did tell a story about the original fermentation.
Oh, yes.
The bun. I think it bears repeating because it was great.
So again, Carolyn Phillips told me that this sauce is originally made by fermenting steamed bun. So manto, it's a northern Chinese bun, but it's also enjoyed elsewhere around the world nowadays. But she said that you traditionally would put it inside a jar and just kind of let it mold and then like let it kind of evolve and ferment into this funky, dark, viscous brown liquid. And she tried it one time and it, lo and behold, it worked. So if you have the courage, you can always give that a try.
Well, I mean, you were very descriptive. You said, you know, you have a look at something that's getting moldy and has that gray fuzz on it. And yeah. I mean, that was... you just have to have patience, wait a little longer until it liquefies, right?
So much of the foods that we eat are fermented, but we don't have to look at the fermentation process. Right. And I'm sure we would be totally grossed out if we did.
Right. And it's interesting because this dish of noodles, upon first glance, you would think, oh, it looks like it would be in traditional style, a little spicy, have all this, you know, a hot hit. But it's not. It's really, as you said, akin to a bolognese sauce.
Yeah. It's not spicy. It's just like savory sweet, I would say. Like kind of like a beautiful like soy saucy glaze and porky. It's delightful.
All right. Talk to me about the prevalence of seafood in the Taiwanese cuisine. Oysters, I know, are all over the place. Right?
Yeah. And I mean... as anywhere that is near the ocean, I think that oysters, you know, in New York, they were once very, very common to, you know, just get on the, just along the piers, you could just grab some, you know, oysters. And, you know, people still do have those nostalgic shops. But yeah, they eat everything from the sea in Taiwan, you name it. And there's wonderful, wonderful, like, seafood markets along, like, coastal areas that you can just, and then have, like, kind of like a small restaurant attached to it. Like in so many countries, right? We've seen this kind of tradition. But there, you know, you can just kind of look at what is being caught in these, you know, maybe baskets, barrels, tanks with fish. Pick your fish and pick a few different ways that they will cook it. One of my favorites is like get a whole fish and then they'll like lightly, quickly pan fry it with some ginger, some scallions, throw in some soy sauce, throw in some rice wine, give it a splash, give it a toss, and boom, you know, turn it onto a plate. Wow. Super fresh. It's so great.
Yeah, that's great. It's, I mean, that's, the food sounds, you know, so fresh. I mean, that's one thing I think can say is fresh food.
Yeah.
It's interesting, this whole mix of, you know, of cultures in it, and so much of how we understand any culture obviously is first through food. If we're new to a culture, we learn about it. When we go to a new culture, we bring our own with it for comfort. And this really shows how a country with so much influence formed its own cuisine by incorporating all these influences together. And that brings me to what you are currently involved in, your podcast, Self-Evident, and that is people of Asian heritage and their experiences in another country, another culture. They're not food, they're people. tell us a little bit about that and what's going on there and what you're attempting to present.
Thanks. So Self-Evident is, driven by stories of real people, you know, not celebrities. We strive to tell the stories that aren't being told, but, you know, are happening and playing out every day from average Asian Americans. And I think that, the real power is like we really, the beauty of it, I think, is that, you know, listeners sometimes then, you know, become hosts or not hosts, but producers, and then tell their stories and like subjects on it. So, for instance, our latest season, we actually co-produced the season, which was a 5-parter of episodes from Lisa Fu, who had, you know, been listening to the show, but she had, you know, this idea for her own podcast she'd been wanting to do for a long time, exploring her mother's and her parents' experiences fleeing Cambodia as refugees and, you know, not really knowing their entire story and kind of finding out much later in life that, you know, all these fascinating, you know, and sometimes horrifying, but also sometimes just really gratifying experiences. And, you know, she wanted to get her mother on tape and record all that. So that's one example of the stories we tell. And now, Linda, you mentioned not food related, but we did just sprinkle in a few food related bits throughout. There was one episode we did that was all about fruit and what it means to various people from Asian American descent, and sharing stories around fruit. That was fun.
Hmm. Well, it's so much fun to shop in the in Chinatown or, you know, the Asian markets. And it's an education, just, you know, walking down and looking at the different stalls and see the different types of fruit. And I mean, we know that it doesn't grow here. Well, not locally in New York. Obviously, they'd have to bring it in from California or places, you know, across the oceans. But it's marvelous. I can imagine the fruit story would be terrific, right?
Yeah, I like your attitude. I think that's a great idea. It's just kind of like stroll and learn and taste and buy things and just try things out. Yeah.
Right. Well, is there anything that you would like to tell us about your feelings on the food of Taiwan or, you know, enjoying food from mixed cultures?
Yeah, I think that's like the really exciting thing that I love exploring right now. I'm based in New York. I'm based in America. I'm not in Taiwan anymore. I can't really comment right now on the evolving cuisines in Taiwan, but lo and behold, in the last decade or so, we've been seeing like a really, really exciting period for Taiwanese American cuisine unfold. And I think that, restaurateurs and also cookbook authors, shout out to Frankie Ga, who recently published First Generation Stories and Recipes from My Taiwanese American Household, I think. Mm-hmm. We're seeing all these stories and all these like interesting recipes evolve and be shared and be discussed. And it's kind of like a really dynamic cuisine that is being written right now, Taiwanese American cuisine, that is. So I'm really excited about, you know, exploring that and seeing that, yeah, and sharing it.
There you are. You've been on that path for a while now, and you have a lot to say, I'm sure. So one thing that I you talked about something I saw in my notes, and because you talked about the noodles being wheat noodles, of course, and wheat is now more prevalent in a lot of those Asian cultures. What about breads?
Yeah, same thing. So, you know, bready stuff was a more northern Chinese specialty, climate reasons again. So if you're from, you know, like southern areas of China, as well as, you know, if you're from Taiwan originally, you would have more rice-based things, rice-based noodles. You see a lot of rice-based noodles that are still being enjoyed widely, as well as rice-based like dumpling wrappers, right? So there's this, you know, there's and sticky rice-based right. things. Mochi stuff is like really, really enjoyed in Taiwan as well. So, now you just have a blend because you have, I mean, and we have this everywhere, right? We can enjoy foods from just about anywhere. But yeah, you just have this blend of like breads, buns from northern, you know, China that is being, riffed on and kind of like adapted with all these different, in all these different ways. What I'm thinking of one night market dish called the nutritious sandwich in Taiwan. Yeah. That is like a deep fried steamed wheat bun. And it's like crispy, and then it's stuffed with like slivered cucumber and ham. It's just like it's wild. Like you don't like see that. I don't know if that you would, you know, find that elsewhere. It's just like it's an invention from some great vendor who just takes some ingredients from here and some ingredients from there and just says, hey, I think this tastes good.
Yeah. I think night markets are fantastic in that regard. I think, you know, so many people are very inventive. They use it as a great, you know, great avenue to explore their own travels. That's terrific. Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, I'm getting hungry, so I'm going to wrap that up. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, Kathy, and you're just so full of information. I want to let our listeners know that The Food of Taiwan is still very much available, and Kathy Irway is the author. And the new book that just came out is the Taiwanese American. What is it?
Win Sun presents a Taiwanese American cookbook.
Win Sun presents Taiwanese American cookbook.
Yep,
that was a slip. Yes. Okay. Well, it's wonderful. And tune in to your self-evident podcast, everyone, if you will. I think there's just some very interesting things coming around. And a great way to learn about cultures and to understand other people as well.
Thank you so much, Linda. It was such a joy to join you on your show.
Great.
Thank you.
A long time coming.
Yeah.
Right. And thank you all so much for listening to A Taste of the Past. A Taste of the Past is sponsored by Heritage Radio Network, and it is a listener-supported network of food podcasts. So tune in. When you tune into this show, tune into the heritageradionetwork.org and consider making a donation. There's always a donate button in the upper right corner. We look forward to having you listen to the next podcast. Thank you. A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.